There comes a time when a nation, whether you define yourself as a nation, as Quebecers or Canadians, to take your heads out of your parochial particularities and your petty concerns. Enough talking about smoking regulations and your daycare centers and your ferry services, and take a look at the world you're in. We're in a world at war, and we're in a world where the world body that's supposed to keep the peace does nothing but appease tyrants. You heard me last night, our last segment, coincided with Iranian President Ahmadinejad's rant at the United Nations. You heard Nani Darwish from Los Angeles say Hitler was at the podium. Canada, you need to pay attention to what's happening at this opening of the General Assembly. If yesterday was Hitler at the podium, today was a puffed-up, pompous Stalin in the form of Hugo Chavez. A collection of tin-pot tyrants, despotic dictators, they are threatening the West on behalf of those who are oppressed. It's time to take a look and say, why are we even bothering, and are they doing more harm than good by validating evil? And with us to discuss this, we're very proud to have Anne Bajewski, who's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and at Touro College Law Center, and editor of eyeontheun.org, and I recommend this website, I as an I-I-Y-E, on the UN.org. Anne Bajewski, thanks for taking the time. I know you've got a tight schedule tonight.
You're welcome.
How much more of this should the West take? America pays a $5 billion bill to hear Hugo Chavez mouth off about the people of the South overtaking the oppressive peoples of the developed nations and Ahmadinejad yesterday.
But
basically saying everything that he does, of including cutting women's heads off and hanging 16-year-old girls who are raped because they shame their families, he blames all that on Western misunderstanding and aggression. How much more of this stomach-turning should we take?
Well, I think the real problem is that for far too long, we thought of the United Nations as some kind of harmless talking shop where everybody just blows off steam. But the reality is that it has turned it became a platform for those who are opposed to all of the values which we hold dear. Canadians think that it's a way of inflating their own stature on the world stage, tying down the hands of Gulliver in the form of America, and inflating their middle power status. But the reality is that it, in fact, does a severe amount of harm. It gives a great deal of control and over the minds and hearts of people all over the world to those who don't share our value system. That's the problem.
It's even more, and by the way, I just want to tell our listeners before all the politically correct out there start having hives at Anne's mention of Canada. She is a Canadian. She's from Toronto. We do have to keep the chattering classes happy in Toronto, Anne. So we're all entitled.
I come at this from I think, the point of view of a good Canadian, and that is
I think you come at this
care about human rights.
Well,
the United Nations isn't doing human rights and protection any favors. I mean, it was founded 60 years ago on the promise of equality of all nations, large and small, and of men and women, and it has done anything but. It's got a Human Rights Council now that's supposed to have replaced its Human Rights Commission, which it's met now for only three sessions. It's now in its fourth. And what has it done? It has adopted only three resolutions. All of them have been directed at Israel, and not a single one directed at Sudan. The United Nations doesn't call what's happening in Sudan genocide. They're afraid to. And they have no definition of terrorism. And when we look really closely, Canadians don't share those values.
You know, but it's even more than a question of values. You have a platform where you have dictators, tyrants, who mean to impose theocratic and political dictatorships on the free world. It's more than values. It's a desire for acquisition of territory and assets. And because they have this stage and reporters need their 800 words and people have the attention span of a gnat and look at things for 6 seconds, it validates these people.
It validates them, yes, indeed. And furthermore, let's take the issue of peace and security. That's the other foundational principle of the United Nations. The biggest threat to international peace and security today is obviously Iran's being hell-bent on acquiring nuclear weapons. And so we haven't been able, however, to have a single sanction put on Iran via the Security Council. even though we're under the mistaken impression that somehow America controls the United Nations. It doesn't. It's under the thumb of the Organization of the Islamic Conference. And if we look at the statistics in terms of ownership of the United Nations, less than half the United Nations members are democratic.
Much less than half out of the 192 countries.
Well, 88 countries out of 192, according to Freedom House standards, but it's not enough to control outcomes. So it means the United Nations is incapable of dealing with the major issues of our time.
And they seem to have no standards of internal discipline as well. We had Hillel Neuer, who's the executive director of UN Watch out of Geneva, on this program, and we were discussing the case of the Human Rights Council meeting that you referred to with Saeed Mortazavi, the prosecutor, the Iranian prosecutor who killed Zahra Kazemir, was involved in her murder, being sent as an observer. Canada, of course, had asked for his arrest, and there was such shock that Canada actually stood up and came to the stood up at the plate and said something courageous, and yet, of course, no response from the UN, no criticism of Iran for sending this guy.
Well, the Human Rights Council the new Human Rights Council, which replaced the Human Rights Commission, was set up without a single solitary criteria for membership. So the new members include Saudi Arabia, China, Cuba, and so will be more of the same. I think that Canada, very unfortunately, has not been forthright about, and this applies to the previous government in particular, but the new government is waiting to be tested, is whether or not we're going to insist on what they call country-specific resolutions, resolutions which specifically say that countries are embarrassment to human rights protection and something has to be done about them. We're waiting to see which way Canada falls out on that, whether we have the courage of our convictions.
Anne Baeski will be right back after this short break. And we're discussing the relevance of the United Nations with Anne Baeski, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and at Touro College Law Center. She's also editor of EyeOnTheUN.org, which I highly recommend to everybody. And just a few final questions, and I know you're pressed by the clock. You were talking about seeing where Canada would be on certain issues. What's a litmus test issue that we should be looking out for that could be coming up shortly?
Well, I think it's whether or not Canada insists at the Human Rights Council session, which began this Monday, on country resolutions, on condemning countries for human rights violations and naming them. That's one test. Is Canada going to put forward some of those resolutions, and how will it stand? We will see it at the General Assembly. There are a number of anti-Israeli resolutions which happen year after year. The UN General Assembly passes 20 resolutions against Israel and not one on China, with a billion people without civil and political rights, for example. So how will Canada vote on those General Assembly resolutions, which are basically ritual condemnations of Israel, ignoring any context whatsoever? Those are some of the litmus tests ahead of us.
Are you shocked when you hear people like Ted Turner, who should know better, talk about how the United Nations has been the resolver of every crisis and the place where people let off steam? Where has he been? Doesn't he know that most of this stuff is done bilaterally?
Well, I think a lot of people are pretty naive about what actually happens at the UN. I think, unfortunately, that we've gotten to a point in democratic societies where we feel intimidated. We feel guilty about past wrongs, which in some respects, of course, we should. But it has tied our hands, and it has it led to a stage of moral relativism where we forgot what's good and bad. And the United Nations exemplifies that. And unfortunately, it feeds into this this moral relativism and insecurity on the part of liberal democracies. And that's what Ted Turner represents.
Anne Baeski, final question. Do we take Hugo Chavez up on his offer to move it to Caracas?
Absolutely.
And many, many thanks.
Or France. Paris would be a good idea, too.
And I want to tell our listeners, you can catch Anne at 9 o'clock on Hannity and Cohn's on the Fox Network tonight, right?
Yes, I can.
Perfect. Anne Baeski, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
For many of you out there who receive our bulletins from the Institute for Public Affairs, you know that we are going to dedicate the rest of the show to a tribute to a great journalist named Oriana Fallaci. Oriana Fallaci died last Friday, and it wouldn't be overstating it to call her, in Robert Spencer's words, a warrior in the cause of human freedom. She was an icon of advocacy journalism for the past half century, but more than that, from her days as a teenager in the anti-fascist resistance in Italy to her last appearances in frail and failing health, she taught us all the primordial responsibility incumbent on public intellectuals and indeed on all those in public affairs, elected or non-elected, to guard liberty and truth with vigor and resolve. In one of her last talks, she spoke words that are perhaps her own most eloquent epitaph. To die a little less when I die, to make people think a little more, outside the dogmas that this society has nourished us with through centuries, to give stories and ideas that help people to see better, to think better, to know a little more. Her life was truly a profile in courage. And in her last years, she wrote a trilogy, starting with The Pride and the Rage, on how the West was not standing up to the specter of dictatorships, to the specter of theocratic tyrannies arising out of the radical Islamic world. She would have had a lot of things to say about the United Nations in this session that we've been looking at yesterday and today, and I couldn't think of a better time to pay a tribute to Anna Falaci than tonight, as we're facing the monstrosities that we're seeing on our television screen from the UN, and I can't think of a better person to start this tribute off with than George Jonas, who is perhaps Canada's most prescient public intellectual. And God help us, George, if you ever stop writing, or God help my sanity. Welcome and good evening.
Good evening, and I am very flattered by your introduction, but for the sake of accuracy, I have to tell your listeners that you're wildly exaggerating.
Wildly, eh?
You're not exaggerating, though, when you're talking about the political arm of Al-Qaeda, which is the UN.
You called Arianna Falaci Europe's Cassandra. Why did you use Cassandra?
An extremely eloquent, intemperate, but not remotely inaccurate way, he called attention to the elephant in the room, which in Europe people refuse to see.
Many people, many listeners may not know, but this trilogy that she wrote, the first was, I believe, The Rage and the Pride, and the second was The Force of Reason, and memory escapes me what the third was. She was actually facing criminal prosecution in her home country of Italy, to which she didn't return until 2 weeks before her death, and would have faced 2 years in prison for, quote, vilification of any religion admitted by the state. And as you wrote, thank God for the First Amendment in the United States. Are we heading for a time, and we're seeing it here in Canada with our political correctness and controlling laws at provincial levels, are we heading for a time where people are going to start looking at what we say and how we say it to the point where we're going to lose any essence of courage and character in our public debate?
We have been living in that time for some time.
Where we have speech crime.
This is not anymore a conjecture about the future. It is a description of the present.
George Jonas, we just take a short break. We'll be right back with you. And we're talking about Arianna Falaci, the great Italian journalist who passed away last Friday. Our special guest is George Jonas. George, we were talking before the break. Arianna Falaci's recent work was aimed at warning the West, a wake-up call. But Christopher Caldwell, as you quoted in your recent column, described her work as a philippic against Islamist terrorism and cowardly Western elites who've permitted it to blossom in their midst. But she took on everything and everybody where she saw freedom being threatened. It wasn't just recent. This has been the hallmark of her career.
She has been the enfant terrible of political journalism all her life. At times she was accurate, at times she was mistaken, but she was invariably courageous. She was the epitome of courage.
You mentioned how she outwitted Henry Kissinger by flattery, were your words. Yet Kissinger said, this was the hardest interview I ever spent. She had a talent for getting into to people's closest circles without the usual constraints. In an interview with Ayatollah Khomeini, she tore off not the chador, but the accoutrements, the garments that she was made to wear, and still got him to laugh.
It was her peculiar talent to deal with, especially, she did interview women, but most of the world leaders she interviewed were men. And she had, in her youth, she was a fiercely beautiful woman.
I like that expression, fiercely.
She was actually both fierce and beautiful, and had an exquisite way of dealing with alpha males who tended to be her interview subjects. Her interview with history is an absolute classic of the genre.
And much of her recent notoriety didn't even start so much with the publication of this trilogy, but actually came earlier than that, when she turned against Arafat and scorched the left in Europe for supporting Arafat, and whom she had once described as a massive trunk, as you quoted, a massive trunk, huge hips, and a swollen belly, summed up in a large mouth with red and fleshy lips. Now, that should make any interviewee in love with her, right?
It is a memorable little passage, and I rather doubt if it escaped Arafat's notice.
Young journalists, let's take Canada, but throughout the West, do they have any of the same sense of burning desire to effect some kind of transcendental change rather than just pumping out their 600 words today, on the whole?
Journalists like Fallaci are rare, and it is perhaps just as well that they are rare. A quality that, if it were common, would not be recognized as unique.
Is it a pendulum that's swinging? I mean, we see eras like the Muckraker era in the first 25 years of the century, and then the 20s and 30s were sort of reporters reporting on crime, and then World War II post-war into the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement, we had more of courageous journalism, and then sort of 80s, 90s, we don't know where it's going. Is this a pendulum that happens as a mirror of society?
Observing it, one is tempted to feel that there is a pendular nature. Many things seem to swing back and forth between certain extremes. It's very hard to say. I think that as the situation that Fallaci was exercised about becomes graver and graver, as I rather suspect it will, there will be an increase in the number of people who will rise to the challenge.
George Jonas, many thanks for spending time with us tonight. Whether you like it or not, you are one of Canada's most important public intellectuals, and I want all our listeners to read this man's work, It Is Wisdom. Go to his website, and he, of course, is a regular columnist for the National Post. And get his book, his latest book, Beethoven's Mask. Thank you, George Jonas.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Take care. We'll be back.
Bye-bye.
Before we continue with our tribute to Arianna Fallaci, let's go to the lines. And Andy, good evening.
Yeah, good evening. Mr. Weisman.
A barrel is enough.
Hello?
Yeah, barrel is enough. No Mr. Necessary.
Okay. The reason I was interested in listening to your program Monday, Tuesday, and tonight, and also the lady that you mentioned, the Italian lady.
Arianna Fallaci.
It's very hard to be like that, and I'll tell you why.
To be like what?
Like this lady, a writer, and who said all those things.
It's always hard to stand up and say what's true and fly in the face of conventional wisdom, yes.
Yes. And it's also very hard because, let's face it, all the radio programs, there are all the radio stations that there are, if you say something, even if it's true, the moderator of the program will try to be...
they'll massage it.
Yeah, so they
the party line. Nobody should be offended. Never mind what's true.
Yeah, this is the problem. No, I guarantee you...
Andy, correct me if I'm wrong, but from your accent, I gather you came from Hungary.
Yes, I did.
Well, I was born in Russia, and so we both know systems where everybody has to fit in.
Yeah.
Aren't you sick of it here? That's not why we came to Canada. Yeah. We came to be free, didn't we?
Right. But the thing is this. Most of the program moderators are looking out for their job. They don't want controversy. And if you say something after they hang up on you or they let you go, they will make comments to smooth out whatever you said. I don't want to be smoothed out.
Neither do I.
I don't want my words to be changed.
Amen.
And by the way, that's why your program can be very interesting. The only thing is that I'd like to put my nails or my fingernails into some of your guests.
Like whom?
Well, the things that they say, it sounds very good, but even your more controversial guests are not willing to go the full route. Of
I usually hear the other way, that they're too extreme. So let me hear an example.
Okay. Yesterday, you had the priest.
Father D'Souza, yes.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that was a total whitewash of the facts, the way it has been. And we're trying to moderate. We're trying to win over people by saying things that are nice and kind. You will never achieve.
Well, you know, it was interesting that you mentioned Father D'Souza, because in his article in the National Post, he was very, very tough. He said, this is the time to speak of tough truths.
Yeah, but
I was trying to get him to say that just to repeat what was on his written page. And you're right. He didn't go the distance.
He was not. I don't want anybody to.
What do you think it is that makes people comfortable writing something, and yet when they have to speak it, they pull back?
Yeah, I can tell you very easily. He wrote it. He got a lot of answers, a lot of reply that was a bit threatening. So when he was on air, he tried to smooth it out. They don't have the guts to say the truth. Now, like I said to you.
As a matter of fact, Andy, I must tell you, I know from a friend of mine, a journalist friend of mine in Toronto, that there was a great deal of negative letters sent in. There were a great deal of positive letters sent in also.
But the
amount of mail that article generated, and all it said was, you know, let's look at what the Pope said in context, was really extraordinary.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
It's a very simple question. You
briefly, Andy, because they're making nasty motions at me from Master Control. We got to pay some bills.
The Quran was the unbelievable what they did to the Quran at the base for the political prisoners or the Al-Qaeda prisoners. Now, let me ask you a question. And they people riot over it, over Quran. If you attack if the caricatures of Muhammad, there's a riot over it. Let me ask you the question. Of all the Siddurs and all the synagogues that have been burned within the last 15...
Siddur is a prayer book, a Jewish prayer book.
Yeah, a prayer book. What? Then we should have burned the whole world.
Andy, I'll answer you very shortly, very briefly.
Yes, sir.
Never mind even the synagogues. I want to see the moderate Muslims march in the streets against the radical Muslims' killing of other Muslims. I'll settle for that. Let them march against the three little girls, Islamic girls, who were beheaded and had acid thrown in their faces before the beheadings for going to a school in Indonesia.
Well,
let them go into the streets against Ahmadinejad, who ordered a 16-year-old girl hung because she was raped. And that supposedly, according to their law, shamed her family. Let them march for their own people.
Davey, you will never see that.
Andy,
that's
thank
why
you.
I say there's no moderates.
Andy, thank you very much. Montreal will be right back. Before we continue with our tribute to Ariana Fallaci and our next guest, I just want to take Scott from Lachute, who has something very important to remind us of that's quite in keeping with the theme of this evening's show. Scott, welcome.
How you doing, Bill?
Okay.
Good. I just wanted to let people know Friday between 12 and 1 on Parliament Hill is Wear Red Friday in support of our troops. This was started, I think it was in Petawawa by some of the wives of our servicemen.
Excellent.
And being, you know, we're in Lachute, for us, it's only an hour drive. And from Montreal, what are we looking at, 2 hours?
Well, the way I drive, an hour and 20 minutes. There, I'm breaking another law. I'm giving everybody fair warning.
I think we owe that to our troops. You know,
absolutely. They're the best of our of what we are.
Well, that's it. Whether you like our prime minister or you don't, whether you support the mission or you don't, we all support our troops. They are the best and the brightest, and they need us there.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you, Bill.
Great. 12 to 1 on Friday in Parliament Hill. A friend of Orana Falachi's named Robert Spencer wrote this about her. She was one of the most fearless and courageous defenders of Western civilization in these latter days, and the West rewarded her by persecuting and vilifying her. Such is the state of the society and culture she loved and tried to save from itself. Our next guest, very special and trenchant observer of the world scene, and particularly the scene of the Middle East and what we're facing in terms of the theocratic tyranny of radical Islam. Daniel Pipes has been a presidential nominee to the U.S. Institute for Peace. He's a founder of Middle East Forum, well-known columnist. Website danielpipes.org is the place to go if you want to know how the Middle East is affecting all our lives, as it seems to be obsessing the United Nations. Daniel Pipes, thank you very much for taking time to join us tonight.
And thank you for the kind introduction, Bill.
I'm understating it. Daniel Pipes, you were, coincidentally enough, I think the last person to introduce her at a public event last year.
I do believe so, yes. She was a recluse the last few years, and she came out for one final time. She got an award from David Horowitz's Center for the Study of Popular Culture. Just a little less than a year ago, and for reasons I'm not exactly sure, she specifically asked for me to do that introduction. So I spent a fair amount of time on her biography. I can't say I did any original research, but I certainly immersed myself in her life and her work for a couple of days.
Well, perhaps you recognize that despite your calm exterior, you shared a common rage, and certainly some of that came out when you said that here is Europe's most celebrated journalist now living in exile in Manhattan because she's wanted for speech crime in her native country. Could you explain a little bit of the background of what happened after she published her trilogy, The Rage and the Pride, The Force of Reason? And now I remember the third book, The Apocalypse, right?
Well, the third book actually isn't out yet in English. It's called Falachi Interviews Herself and the Apocalypse, right?
Right.
She was born in 1930. She was from early on politically involved. Her father was a leader in the fight against Mussolini. She took part in the resistance as a teenager. She, as a teenager, pretended to be older and got a journalistic job. She was on the left for most of her career. She was a prominent, internationally prominent journalist, especially as an interviewer. Had some of the most famous and interesting people of her time go under go through the experience of her interview. She really boned up and knew, asked tough questions. But then, from about 1985 on, she went silent and just didn't write anymore. She was a recluse. She didn't write. And only after 9/11 did she find her voice again.
And the famous, I believe it was the famous diatribe against Western Europe that was commissioned by Corriere della Sera in Milan.
Right. She came out with a very long newspaper article in Corriere della Sera and turned that into the first of the three books.
It's very interesting that you mentioned that she came out of the left. Now, the left, you know, I think we both came to political maturity at the same time, and the left in the 60s and the 70s into the early 80s opposed tyranny, opposed oppression, opposed those governments and those governors that would make us march in lockstep to any kind of dogma or doctrine. Today, they were in the press, they were in the media, the left, the progressives, they called them. Today,
your left and mine were the same. I remember my left apologizing for the Soviet Union, for Cuba, for Maoist China, not entirely antagonistic to.
You're right too. I'll take the correction. Let's call it progressives. There was a certain kind of muscular journalism around that said, nobody's going to tell me, I just wanted to get to this point, nobody's going to tell me how to think. Now, there were apologists for the left. You're quite correct. The point I was getting at was, what is it about today's journalists, today's media, that moves away from criticizing the very same kind of ideological tyranny, never mind just political and military tyrannies coming out of the radical Islamic world, but the ideological tyrannies that the progressives out of which she came would have opposed? What is it about
I think the logic is fairly simple. The left, and especially more the further left you go, criticizes the West, believes that we, the capitalism, our system, our ideas are the problem. And the Islamists agree that we are the problem.
So therefore, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and failed states have a right to be wrong because it's all the West's fault that made them failed in the first place.
It's not so much enemy of my enemy. It's we have a common foe, and although we are very different, say the position of women could not be more different, and in many, many details are extremely different, the role of religion, we do have a common opponent. And however large our differences may be, we have a premise for working together. And that's what has been the case, especially dramatic in the last decade or so.
Daniel Pipes, we just have to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you. And you can email us with your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. And we're very privileged to have with us Professor Daniel Pipes, founder of Middle East Forum, danielpipes.org. Go to that website if you want to understand the seminal issue that is deciding our fate in the world today. Dan, we were talking before the break about the media and their unwillingness in great part to take on the reality of what we're facing in terms of global jihad, but it's not just the media, is it? In Canada, there's this great debate on our mission in Afghanistan. What's our exit strategy? And I recall an article recently by someone, and the title was, Churchill had no exit strategy. What is it about the West today that it cannot see that you have to fight evil before it sweeps over you?
I think the key difficulty is seeing in radical Islam a worthy enemy. In other words, if one goes back to, say, the Nazis and Churchill, it didn't take much imagination to see in the serried ranks of soldiers, the endless tanks, planes, and ships, a formidable, menacing enemy. The Islamists don't have anything like that. They have box cutters and bombs, but they don't have anything like not only our military arsenal and manpower, but they don't have our economy, they don't have our control of territory. Therefore, it takes imagination to understand that this truly is a threat. It is quite easy to see this, as John Kerry famously did 2 years ago, as a nuisance. That's the word he used, as a nuisance, comparable. And he drew this comparison to gambling and prostitution, something that's there, you know, bad, but manageable.
Yeah.
You can live with it.
So our public philosophy, to use Walter Lippmann's famous phrase, hasn't got the imagination or the wit to see beyond the fact that this is a new kind of army. It doesn't have the uniforms of the Nazis. It doesn't have the panzer divisions. But it's got oil. It's got money. It's got tens of thousands of kamikazes ready to kill themselves. But our public imagination can't grasp that.
Well, half of our public imagination.
Right.
I think there's a division in every Western country between the more conservative elements who do see it and the more liberal elements who do not. Now, where conservatives are in the majority, then the government and the media and the institutions of public life are more attuned to this, and where they're not, they don't. I mean, a dramatic example would be...
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm almost... This is a particular bone of mine that... I almost feel as if the word liberal, smaller liberal, classic industrial liberalism, has been hijacked by people who have no idea what it is. Liberalism means at its heart liberty. And you know, I don't know if the old labels fit anymore. And I,
true, and neither does conservatives today.
Right.
But classically did. We use these terms differently from, say, 2 centuries ago. But... You know, they do point to an important distinction, two philosophical outlooks.
Daniel Pipes, final question. Here's Arianna Fallaci, a member of the liberal progressive left, even as you said, not writing for a good number of years. It was just 9/11 that sparked her attack on Western Europe's lethargy, or was there more than that? I mean, certainly she didn't need to be woken up by a terrorist event of that magnitude.
I don't actually know. Her last book, I just checked, was in 1992, before this current trilogy. I don't actually know if it was 9/11 specifically that awoke her. I would tend to think so, but I don't know enough to be specific about that.
Daniel Pipes, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you for the opportunity and invitation.
A pleasure. Okay. Let me just end with a few more words from Oriana Fallaci's friend Robert Spencer. In his tribute to her, he said, "What can I do for Oriana? The only answer is to do exactly what I'm doing and trying to do now, and alerting people to the reality and magnitude of global jihad. I ask you, I invite you on this day of sadness and loss," he wrote, "to pay tribute to her. There's no way to make up for what we have lost in losing Oriana, except by becoming Oriana. Let there be 100 new Orianas today, 1,000 new passionate and articulate and absolutely unbowed defenders of Western culture and civilization, with a fine contempt for all the many weapons of physical and psychological intimidation that the jihadists and their non-Muslim allies and tools in the Western media and government establishments use to silence and discredit everyone else." Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, my friends, "One person, resolute, abiding by the truth, shall rally a majority." That is the legacy of Oriana Fallaci. We'll be back with you tomorrow night. Thank you to Nick Mays and Master Control. Have a good evening.